Not sure there is a hotter topic right now than that of abortion. Ever since that monumental Supreme Court decision a few weeks ago that overturned Roe versus Wade, there's been a lot of talk about abortion. There's been a reaction on both sides. There have been lots of people who are celebrating, and then, of course, there's a side who is outraged at the constitutional right that has been taken away. And I want to say in the very beginning that this is a big victory. I don't want to minimize that. And I am confident that the overturning of that decision, because that decision stood for 50 years and it essentially made abortion legal in all states. And the fact that that has been overturned, I don't have any doubt in my mind that that is going to save a lot of lives. However, I know, and I want you to know, and I think you know this, this is not going away. And at the risk of sounding really pessimistic, I think it is important for us to think about what kinds of things are going to happen now. And so essentially abortion now, the legality of it resides at the state level. And it's yet to be determined what every state's going to do. Right now, it's kind of still up in the air. This is still being battled out in individual states. Alabama, for instance, is completely banning abortions for any reasons, and that's not likely to change anytime soon, if ever. And there are about 20 other states who are kind of along that line. They either have a full abortion ban or it is mostly, meaning there are lots of restrictions when it comes to it. But then there's another handful, about 17 or so states right now, where abortion is almost entirely legal, meaning they don't have hardly any restrictions, if they have any restrictions at all. With the overturning, there were immediately about 6 states who expanded abortion rights because they recognized that there are going to be people who have lost their right to an abortion, and so they wanted to be serving to all of those people. And so you can tell there's lots of movement going on right now on the state level when it comes to what's going to happen with abortion. Regardless, though, of what happens from state to state, there are going to be some ways around whatever the laws are. You've probably heard about some of this in the news. There are some larger corporations and probably some smaller businesses that will do the same. You just don't hear about them in the news. But there are some larger corporations who say if you work for this corporation and you live in a state where abortion is not legal, then we will pay for you to go have that done where it is legal. And so they're trying to offset what the law might be doing. There are other ways. There's an abortion pill that can be used in some sources and now, or some cases, and some may think that this may be something that can be gotten by mail, and in that case it wouldn't really matter what state you lived in. And there are other loopholes. It's not my intention to talk about all of those. I just want you to know what is going on. What all of this says is I think we can expect change in some capacity over and over again, because this is a political issue in the sense that it really just takes the scales tipping in one direction or another. What's going to happen in most states really right now depends on who controls the legislature in that state. But you know what happens with who controls the legislature or who controls any body of government? That is likely to change. And so we haven't seen the end of this. The scales could tip in either direction, really just depending on getting enough people on one side or another. But regardless of what the law does, we're still living in a country right now where the majority of Americans agree that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. According to Pew Research, just last month, about 61% of Americans believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. Now, we could spend lots of time breaking that 61% down by race and where they live, and not going to do that, just 61%. And there is an alarming number of Christians who are starting to throw their support towards abortion, at least in some cases. And so all of that being said, I think this makes discussing abortion very timely. And I think it just reinforces the idea that we need to be standing on the truth when it comes to this. This is a matter where truth is going to be questioned. And we need to be able to firmly stand on truth. And what I want you to understand is truth does not come from what I want. Truth is not a matter of my opinion on it. Truth isn't a matter of your opinion. Truth is not a matter of what the courts decide. Truth is not a matter of what the majority of the people want or what the majority of the people say. Truth is from God. And so I want us to dig a little bit tonight in the truth about this particular matter. And I want to just ultimately show you some of the arguments. And one way what I want to do tonight is I want to prepare all of us to handle the arguments, because the arguments are seen and heard regularly for those who advocate abortion. But I want to start with a very fundamental thing in the beginning. I want to establish something fundamental, and that helps us answer really every question, every scenario when it comes to abortion. I think we can do that with just a couple of Bible verses. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 26. This is likely a familiar verse to everybody. But then God said, "Let us make man in our image according to our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky and over the cattle and over the earth and every creeping thing that creeps into the earth." Now we know this is from God's account of creation. And on the sixth day, God created man. But there are two important things that are established here. One is that life comes from God, meaning that the authority of life resides with God. I can't give life and you can't give life. And so the authority of life resides with God. That is one important thing that is established here. There's a second thing that is important. And it says, "Let us make man in our image." This separates man from every other thing that God created. It separates man from the animals. It certainly separates man from every other physical thing that God created. And so just from this verse alone, we can establish some truth about life, that the authority of life resides with God, and that life has a supreme value. One other verse that we can put with this is in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 6. Now this is right after the flood. And God is telling, what is the penalty for a person who takes the life of another person? And He says that penalty is their life. Notice what He says there. "Whoever sheds man's blood, by his blood shall be shed, for in the image of God he made man." Now, what I want you to see there is the basis. Why is it wrong for one human being to take the life of another human being? Well, the reasoning is based on what? "For in the image of God he made man." And so I think just from these two verses alone, we can establish the authority of life resides with God and that life has a supreme value. And I want to suggest, if both of those things are true, then this statement that is then true. It is not morally permissible for one human being to take the innocent life of another human being. I think we can make that statement just based on those two verses, just based on those principles that we just looked at, that it is not morally permissible for one human being to take the innocent life of another human being. And so if we can firmly establish that, then there are no arguments that would justify abortion. I want you to see that clearly. We're establishing a fundamental truth from which every argument will come back to. And if those things are true, then there is no argument that will justify abortion. And so let me just now run through some of the arguments with you. Here is an argument that is probably heard more than any other. You hear this all of the time. "My body, my choice." So that's the cry of the woman that says, "This is my body, therefore it is my choice what I do with it." And no other person would have the right to tell her what to do because it is her body, especially a man, right? A man certainly couldn't, but really, essentially, no one can say that. Well, there's a sense in which "my body, my choice" is not entirely wrong. I do feel like there are certain rights that I have, and you have certain rights. The fallacy of this argument, though, is that the baby in the womb is not just a part of her body. It is another human being altogether. And if it is another human being altogether, then guess what we cannot do? We cannot take its life. Why? Because we've already established a very fundamental truth about life, that we don't have the right to take an innocent human life. We'll spend some time on this argument, more on this one than any of the others, because I think this is one that we hear a lot, and there are a lot of facets to it. But I will tell you, the pro-choice advocates cannot concede this argument. They have to hold on very tightly to this idea that the baby is just a part of the mother's body. Do you know why? Because if they concede and say, well, it is its own body, it is a human being, guess what abortion then becomes? It becomes murder, doesn't it? And so they can't acknowledge that it is its own body. They can't acknowledge that it is its own life. And so they have to hold on tightly. They can't concede that. And you see that in the language that's used to talk about abortion. Do you hear people, when they talk about abortion and they're in favor of abortion, do you hear them talk about aborting babies? No. They don't call them babies. And they don't call them children, and they don't call it life. They call it a clump of cells. Or they call it a fetus. And do you know why that's the preferred language? Because those sound like things, not people. That's very dehumanizing type language. And so even in the way that abortion is talked about, it is everything to avoid calling it a life, calling it a human, calling it a baby. It is all about dehumanizing what's in the womb. Well, there are some problems. Even if you say what's in the womb in the very beginning is just a clump of cells, there are some problems with that. For one, science can tell us that what is happening, there is development happening from the very beginning, which means there is life there, because dead things don't do anything, right? And so there is life that is happening there. And there is a lot of proof that there is conception, or life exists from conception itself. Now, is there any question about the child in the womb being dependent on the mother's body? No, you couldn't make that argument. You could say the child in the womb is still dependent on the mother's body, right? But just because the child in the womb is dependent on the mother, that does not make it any less human, does it? Think about it in these terms. What about children outside of the womb? Is it safe to say that children outside of the womb are still dependent on others? That does not make them any less human, does it? I have three children, and guess what? At 7, 5, and 3, they're still really dependent. Me and Katie have a lot of work to do to make sure that they have everything that they need to be able to sustain life. And some of you have that. Some of you are wondering when the kids are going to get off the payroll. And so what we're thinking about is a child that is in the womb may very well be dependent on its mother's body. But that doesn't make it any less human, does it? I think about a baby that is 3 days old versus a baby that is 3 years old. Is it safe to assume that they are in way different places as far as their development goes? Well, sure they are. The three-year-old is way more developed than the three-day-old. But the three-day-old is still a human, right? Just like the three-year-old is. And so what biology will tell us, what science will tell us, is that at conception, everything that a baby needs to be human already exists. The only thing missing is time. The only thing missing is the time for that baby to develop. And so it's not a matter of, is it a human or is it not a human? It is only a matter of where it is in the developmental stage. And it being in this developmental stage versus this developmental stage does not change the fact, it does not erase the fact that it is still human. Now, we could go down this route a lot. You think about what science will tell us about the development in the womb and all of the things that start happening. All of the markers that say this is a human are evident all along the way, like DNA. That's going to determine the color of the eyes and the color of the hair, and that starts being present. And then there's the heartbeat, and there's the brain waves, and there's all of these other functions and things that are happening. And all of those are well detectable before birth. And so the question then becomes, well, when does life really begin? When does life begin? And the challenge that I issue is that if it's not at conception, then when is it? If it's not at conception, when is it? If you want to prove that what's in the womb is not yet alive, the burden of proof is on you. You have to be able to prove that. And guess what you're doing? You are just drawing an arbitrary line as to where you think life begins. Because there's widespread disagreement. If we don't agree on at conception, then who knows where the line should really be drawn? Because some people will say that it's at a heartbeat, or when it's viable, or when they take the first breath of life, that's when life begins. Well, that leads us to a scary place, right? Because if you hold to that line, that life doesn't begin until the first breath, guess what that means? That means that you could take a baby 1 minute before it's born, and you could abort it. Why? Well, it hasn't taken its first breath yet. Do you see where this goes? And I will suggest that people are not drawing the line because that's where the evidence lands them. People are drawing the line because that's where they want the line to be drawn. That's the reality. And so if we're trying to now make up when life begins at any time other than conception, then people are all over the board with that. And so we're bombarded with this, when does life begin argument? Well, the Bible can weigh in on this. It doesn't just establish the things already said, that life comes from God and that life has a supreme value. The Bible itself doesn't even make a distinction in the way that it describes a baby in the womb and a baby on the outside. Let me just give you a few verses. You remember in Luke chapter 1 and verse 41, there's Elizabeth, that's the mother of John the Baptist, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and they greet each other. And Luke says, what? The fetus? Or the clump of cells? No, Luke says it's the baby that leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. And so you see, already called a baby, the fact that it's leaping, I think, would say something about life existing there. But then later on, when he's recording about the birth of Christ, this will be a sign for you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger. Do you see how when the Bible is talking about what's in the womb versus what's already been born, there's no distinction there. They're both babies, right? We could go on with this. Psalm 119, Ronald read for us the first 12 verses of that. And I have that read because it's a description of not being able to escape God. We're not able to escape God. Wherever we go, God has this intimate knowledge of us. But when we get to Psalm 139 verse 13, things change a little bit because it says God doesn't just know that for those who are outside of the womb. God knows that for those who are still in the womb. Psalm 139 puts God's stamp on life from the very beginning, and it does it in a very definitive way. For you, God, you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and willfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Do you see God's stamp on life here? And it is God that is creating that life. And it is certainly in the womb. In Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 5, the text says, before I formed you in the womb. That word before, I think, is important there, isn't it? Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I have appointed you a prophet to the nations. And so here's just a logical question. If we're not certain when life begins, then they say there's 9 months in the womb. And you take passages like Psalm 139 and Jeremiah chapter 1 and say, all right, well, at what month in the womb were those under consideration? Again, if you say anything other than at conception, there's no basis for that argument. And so we recognize one more passage here in Exodus chapter 21. I think this is a definitive answer on the subject. This is talking about the laws of Israel. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay his judges, or pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, I think an injury to the baby, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. What's in the womb there is life. And so we could go on with that, but I hope you understand that life is life from the beginning. It is the work of God. And you and I have no ability to put a stamp on exactly at what point we might think that's happening. Again, if it's anything other than conception, then what basis would you make that argument? And so I think there's one other thing to think about, because everything I've said up until this point has just been what we can tell from science, biologically speaking. But even science has its limitations. You know what science can't do? Science cannot define life. Science cannot give a value. I'm thinking about an important truth that we know, that human beings are more than just a body. Do you recognize that? That your life is more than just the physical body that we have? You also were created in the image of God. And one thing that means is that there is an eternal nature to us. God gave us a spirit. God gave us a soul. James 2 mentions that, the body and the soul. Well, guess what science would be unable to determine then? At what point is that coming into play? Now, having three children, I've sat through lots of ultrasounds. And you know what ultrasounds can do? They can look in there and they can measure the baby. And they can tell how the baby is growing and measure all these other things. And they can look and see if it's got all its fingers and toes. And they can look and determine the sex of the baby. And guess what? It's either a boy or a girl. They can determine that. But there's also this ability to see maybe there's some abnormality. But do you know in all the ultrasounds that I've been in, they have never said, oh, this is about the time that we see the spirit or the soul of the baby develop. You see, science has some real limitations because it cannot define life. It cannot define value. Only God can do that. And every bit of evidence that we have says that God has caused this life. God has created this life, and it has been a life from the very beginning. And so there is not a defensible path that you can go down trying to make some self-determination as to when life begins. Let me move on to a second argument. The argument is, that's the answer to the baby in the womb is a human life, and we have no right to take that life. Let me move to the second argument, is that the mother will be negatively affected if she is forced to have the child. That is an argument that you hear pretty regularly. Again, I want you to notice the language there. They paint it in such a tragic sounding way. And I'm not dismissing that there are tragic situations. We're about to talk about that. But I want to just mention this before we get into some of these other situations. It is important, I think, for us to see that the overwhelming majority of arguments for abortion are emotional arguments. The overwhelming majority of arguments are emotional arguments. To hear a pro-choice advocate speak, you would think that almost every abortion is the result of some terrible scenario, or it is the result of some unavoidable consequence, or it is some situation where a life is hanging by a thread. And the reality is that is almost never true. Almost never true. The reality is that the overwhelming majority of abortions are due to unwanted pregnancy. That's the reality. The emotions just become a trap. And so those who advocate for pro-choice will constantly be pushing these outlier situations to the front. And I understand why. It's because emotions bring people in. In emotions trap, people are swayed by emotions. And so almost every time you hear someone make an argument for pro-choice, they're using some emotional argument to do that. And I'm not saying emotions are not involved, because they are, but emotions can't determine truth. That's important. Emotions can't determine truth. Emotions cannot erase the fundamental truth that we've already established about life. And so I will tell you a couple of the scenarios that are often painted, thinking about the mother being negatively affected. Sometimes you'll hear a scenario, and this happens. You'll hear a scenario where here is a young girl, maybe it's a teenage girl, and she's just in high school or she's at the very beginning of college, and she becomes pregnant. And if she is forced to have this baby, then that's going to alter the trajectory of her life in some negative way. And so because the mother is going to be negatively affected, they will use that to justify the abortion. Maybe it's not a teenager. Maybe it's an older woman. And maybe she's already got some children of her own. And maybe the father is not going to be in the picture. That happens a lot. And so now you have a situation where a mother is thinking, I may not be able to afford this child, or I may not be capable of bringing another child into the world. And so some would say, well, if she's not going to be capable of bringing that child into the world, then they would justify an abortion. Those are bad situations. I don't argue that at all. But bad situations do not change the fundamental truth. You see how we keep going back to that fundamental truth? A bad situation does not change the fundamental truth about life. No human being has the right to take the life of another innocent human being, even if that might have an adverse effect on the mother that brings that child into the world. There are some similarities in this argument. But this is one that is arguably difficult to think through. And it is certainly emotional, where they make an argument about how the child would be, or how the child is conceived. And I think when we start getting into some emotional arguments like this, this is where some Christians actually get on board. They would say, no, I'm not in favor of aborting a child just because it's an unwanted pregnancy. I'm not in favor of it just because it's going to be an inconvenience if the child comes into the world. However, in certain situations they would advocate. But what I want to share with you is not even the tough situations justify. Thinking about rape, and I certainly don't want to be insensitive, because that's a terrible, despicable, deplorable crime. And if I were in charge of what happened to the man who commits that type of crime, it would be a much more severe punishment than what they get now. However, that doesn't change the fundamental truth, does it? The fact that a pregnancy is a result of a terrible tragedy doesn't change the fact that a life is a life. And if it is in the womb, guess what it is? It is still alive. Is the fetus somehow less human because of the circumstances? Well, the obvious answer is no. Is it only a human if it were conceived by two loving parents in a good family, a good relationship? Well, certainly not. And so while this is a terrible tragedy, it's a bad situation, and while we might look at this and acknowledge that a person in this situation is going to need help and they're going to need resources and they're going to need solutions, a bad situation doesn't change the truth. That it's not morally permissible to take the life of another human, an innocent human. The child conceived in bad situations is still an innocent child. And so if we go that route to justify abortion, we run into a problem, right? And here is the problem with that. Even tragic events don't change the fact. If a child is in the womb, it is still an innocent child. Part of this is just a matter of the world that we live in. Tragedies like this are just reminders that we live in a world that is under the rule of Satan. This is a direct result of living in a world that is under the sway of Satan. And so one thing we might allow these situations to do, while we wouldn't allow them to justify taking an innocent life, we would use situations like this to strengthen our resolve to be what God wants us to be. And to lessen our attraction to this world. You know, sometimes people ask the question, why does God not stop more than He does? Why does God let so much bad stuff happen? Because God could stop it, right? Why does He not? I don't know the answers to that because I'm not God, but I have a theory. And my theory, from my own experience, is that I'm already too attached to this world as it is. And maybe, some of the tragic things, not just this subject, but some of the tragic things, maybe those are made to make me long for God even more. Let me give you another argument and we'll wrap this up. There is an argument that's prevalent that if the child is born, it will just never have a decent quality of life. Well, when we determine to start taking a life because it's not going to have an acceptable standard, there are a couple of problems there. And the first problem is that we don't get to play God. It is not my right to determine who comes into this world and who leaves this world. And so that's one problem. The other problem is who gets to determine what an acceptable quality of life is. Now, we can all recognize that there is such a thing as a quality of life, and perhaps there's a scale or there's a spectrum. But really, that would become very arbitrary just based on the way that a person feels. So I want to pose this question to you. If we start opening the door that says it's okay to end a life if we deem that it's going to have an unacceptable quality, then why stop at the baby in the womb? If you're advocating for the quality of life, you've got some real logical arguments that you're not going to be around. If we're going to decide for a baby that hasn't been born yet, then why can't we decide for a baby that's just been born? Here's what I mean. When we get in there in that ultrasound or we do the blood test, sometimes medical technology is able to determine this child is going to have some serious defects or some abnormalities. Testing just allows us to know that, or at least gives us some idea that we might expect that when this baby is born. But you know what? Testing doesn't catch everything. Maybe the baby comes out, and the minute that it's born, it becomes very evident that there is something wrong with this child, and the test just didn't catch it. And so now we're just minutes into the life. Somebody's there holding the newborn baby. Would it be permissible to just end its life right there because we've determined it's not going to have a good quality of life? Only a despicable person would say yes to that, right? Now, if we're not willing to say yes to it, with the baby that's just been born, then why are we willing to say yes to it just on the other side of the womb? Do you see the fallacy there? Do you see the inconsistency there? That's flawed reasoning. And what if we started thinking about this quality of life beyond just babies? I mean, why limit it to babies? What about older people? What if as a person ages, we start to determine their quality of life is going downhill and is not coming back the other direction? And so what if we determine, well, they're kind of losing their mind a little bit, or they're losing their ability to see for themselves, and they're going to be dependent on other people, and maybe they're just not ever going to make it back to where they really want to be. Do we get to just send them on out? And again, where would we draw the line as to what is acceptable and what is not? Do you see how arbitrary the lines are and how unclear? What if it was just a person who is missing a limb or becomes paralyzed? I mean, where do you close the door if you've opened up the door for the quality of life? And if you're willing to make the quality of life argument, why stop with physical things? Because I will tell you what we could do in a matter of minutes. We could get in our vehicle and somebody here could help us find what we would deem the worst side of town. And we could find what we might describe as almost inhumane living conditions. We could find some young children in gut-wrenching situations. Would it be okay to just end their life there on the spot? That sounds terrible. But if we're going to argue that the quality of life determines whether you get to stay or not, then where does that line stop? Where do you close that door? And so I hope you understand the problem is that we don't get to decide who comes into this world and who leaves this world because we are not God. If there is a child in the womb and it's been determined that that child has some abnormalities, guess what it still is? Still a child. Still having its inward parts formed by the same God that formed mine. And I don't have the right to say no to that life. And you don't either. Well, let me just go back to what I've said over and over and over again. And I know that's redundant, but fundamental truths are powerful when you're sorting through lots of scenarios and arguments and situations, especially when they're emotional. I think it's important to have a fundamental truth to rely on. And so hopefully that's what I've been able to do. Katie and I were discussing this afternoon. And she said, I don't like sermons like this. And I don't think she meant that to be offensive to the preacher. I hope not. I think the sentiment is I don't even like the fact that we have to think about it. I don't either. I will tell you, there are some sermons that I enjoy preparing. And I'm really excited to share something with you. And believe it or not, this is not one of those. But it's the world that we live in. And it's a moral issue of our day that we'll have to tackle over and over again. And so hopefully something has been said tonight that helps you be able to do that. I also think that every time we're thinking about life, in any capacity, it's important to think about our own life. Especially from that idea that's already been expressed, that God created us in His image, which means there is an eternal nature to our souls. And the choices that you and I make right now are going to determine the fate of our eternal life. And so I want you thinking right now, what does your eternity look like based on the choices that you're making right now? And maybe you're making all the right choices, but maybe you're not. Maybe you know the right choices, but you just know you're not making them. Or maybe you don't even know what those choices are. But if either of the latter are true, I want you thinking very clearly, what am I going to do now? If the choices that I'm currently making are not favorable for eternal life, the question lies with you, what are you going to do about that? And I would love for someone to acknowledge that they want to start making the right choices tonight. That would be a great way to end. And so you're going to have two options. We're going to stand and we're going to sing this invitation song. And you'll have an opportunity to come to the front and just let me know what's on your mind and what you need to do next. Maybe you're ready to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. Maybe there's just some confession that you need to make and you just need prayers. Maybe it's not a confession of sin. Maybe it's just a confession of a struggle and you need prayers. That can happen right now. Maybe it's just a lot of questions and you want to do that in a more private setting where there's more time for conversation. You have that option too. All you have to do is find me afterwards and I'll be glad to have that conversation with you. But we'd love for you to get the help that you need for your soul tonight. Let's stand and sing.